Menards has everything you need for your next big project. Update the lighting in your garage or workspace with our great selection of utility lighting options. The High Bay Light features a 5,000 Kelvin color temperature, wet rated, and a long life over 100,000 hours, so you'll have light for whenever you need. Get the 11 inches High Bay Light for $89.99. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals.
Save big money at Menards.
Talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auchteroin, Argus, Akoiza.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, the unhappy early life of Eamon de Valera and how he seemed an unlikely future leader, power and change in rural Ireland in the century after independence, and to end the show, how language evolved and how we talked our way out of the Stone Age and into today's digital age. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. Eamon de Valera had little interest in politics before 1916. Born in New York, he was raised as Eddie de Valera in rural Limerick, his mother absent, his father gone. A lonely child, he became Eamon later. And a new book looks at how Eamon de Valera became who he was. The book is called Dangerous Ambition, The Making of Eamon de Valera. It's published in paperback by Eastwood Books. The author is Colm Kenny. And Colm, you're very welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, Patrick.
It's fascinating the way people are still intrigued by Eamon de Valera. People have strong views on him. People are intrigued and people are always interested in the views of the biographer and what they think of him.
Indeed, here we are nearly 100 years after the foundation of Fianna Fáil. And it's a funny thing, since I wrote this book, people keep sidling up to me and sort of saying in a soft voice, what do you really think of Eamon de Valera? And that's why I concentrate in this book on his early life, because it tells us a lot about the guy. His lonely birth in New York, the way his mother sent him back to Ireland and refused to take him back to the United States later, even though he pleaded for that. His upbringing in a labourer's cottage in Limerick and how he pulls himself up by his bootstraps. It's a great human interest story and it tells us a lot about his character, I think. He was a very individual, lonely child out on the hillside looking after cattle, reading a biography of Napoleon. But you see this, you form this impression of somebody who knew he was only going to have to depend on himself to get ahead, and who struggles incredibly hard to get scholarships and make his way from this labourer's cottage through national school to the Christian Brothers, gets into Blackrock College, gets a degree from the Royal University of Ireland, registers for another degree in Trinity College. I mean, how many people from that background did that? He was a man of extraordinary personal dedication, but also a man who saw himself as somehow apart from everybody else.
The mystery around his father is a very important one, and he seems to have been searching for that missing father for many years afterwards, and even in terms of trying to track down the family coat of arms and get that all approved. And the fact that he was never really able to find any evidence of this mysterious de Valera, it does lead you to wonder, was this just a story the mother had kind of invented?
He was absolutely obsessed with this. He got three Irish ambassadors in Spain working on it, as I spoke about recently in a paper I gave on this in Toledo in Spain at a conference. He had senior Catholic figures working in the United States to trace it. Nobody's ever found any birth certificate, marriage certificate, death certificate. And even now, when you can access the US census over many years, you won't find evidence of this individual. And it does look like either it was a person who never existed or someone who was on the scene very briefly. And even his mother said that this man had left her and had died a couple of years after de Valera's birth. He was upset by this for personal reasons. First of all, he wanted to know where he came from, but also being, as they called it, illegitimate, was an impediment. And it was used at election time very brutally against him on the doorstep. I mean, people thought less of you in those days, I think, if you weren't, if you like, born to married parents. And of course, there was his long-standing desire to become a priest. He toyed for many years with this vocation, for 10 years, took it very seriously. Nobody was ever very clear as to why any priest he ever met seems to have discouraged it. But illegitimacy would have been an impediment to becoming a priest in those days.
The image that we have of De Valera is of someone who was austere, humorless, you know, fairly strict in his conduct. But yet, when we look at the early years, there was the occasional drinking, there was the occasional hijinks. It's a different character than the one we think of when we think of the older De Valera.
Yes, sir, nobody's completely black and white. I mean, he loved to play rugger. He played rugby for 10 years in Rockwell and Belvedere, and his friends, the Ryan brothers, much older than him in Rockwell, were well-known Irish internationals, brothers who paid for one of the first Irish teams to win the Triple Crown, the predecessor of the Six Nations. And, you know, he would go out drinking with them, and stories like this, you know, exist that show there was another side to De Valera. But he certainly had a very austere side too, so it's not surprising. And in some ways, you know, I think certain aspects of De Valera have got played down over time, including the whole rugby side. I mean, the concept of the later very nationalist Gaelic De Valera having played rugger and having been at Belvedere and spoken at debates in which he frowned on republicanism and praised Napoleon, these kind of didn't fit the image of De Valera that later had to be cultivated.
And the move to Blackrock College was one that was so important to him, because again, we think that this is the person who loved the rural life, the rural existence, but he was just delighted to get away and get to the city.
Oh no, he couldn't wait to get away. He remembered a young friend of his who'd gone off to work in a shop somewhere, and he reflected on the fact that here I was going to spend the rest of my life digging spuds for his uncle who was bringing him up. But he pulled himself up by his bootstraps, as I say. He sought what were called exhibitions in those days, or scholarships, and he won them to the Christian Brothers first in Charleville. And then by a stroke of good luck, his parish priest met on holidays in County Clare the principal of Blackrock College, and he was telling him about De Valera being quite a bright boy, and the principal, out of the kindness of his heart, said he would take De Valera on the scholarship, even though the scholarship was worth only half the fees for Blackrock. And De Valera was absolutely delighted he got there. He said he couldn't understand other boys crying when their parents left him off, or sometimes when they couldn't afford to go home, perhaps for Easter holidays. For him, he said it was heaven. That was the word he used. He was able to dedicate his time to reading and learning. He loved reading, and he was well fed and looked after and had opportunities to play sport. Again, the sporting side of him, not just rugby, other sides of it too have been played down, as has his incipient vocation. I mean, there has been a cultivation of an image of De Valera which doesn't capture the true overall humanity of the youth and of the young man.
And yet, if you were to look at that young man and you were to see him, the student, the scholar, the rugby player, you wouldn't have necessarily thought that he was someone destined to be a great national leader. I don't think he seemed to exude that charisma or that leadership potential that was so evident later.
Not really at all. In fact, he had no interest in politics worth talking about. He had a normal Irish Catholic youth's nationalist sentiments, but it's not till he gets into his 30s that you see him turn to politics, and even into his late 30s he turns to radical, if you like, nationalism. What he wanted to be most of all was a maths professor. And he tried hard. He applied for the job, even though he was too short a time out of college to have hoped to have got it, I think, in any realistic sense. He made a serious effort to become Professor of Mathematics at Cork, pressing into his service the Irish Parliamentary Party apparatus in Cork, J.J. Horgan and members of the governing body of UCC who belonged to that party. And in fact, the governing body seemed to support him. But once his application got into the university itself and the academics looked at his qualifications, while he had a certain gift for mathematics, he certainly didn't have the required level of capability. And that seems to have embittered him, actually. And it wasn't long long after that that he seems to have taken a serious look at his chances of advancing politically. He joined the Irish Volunteers, which was not a very radical thing to do. Many people did that. But he drifted on into the ambit of Pádraic Pearse and that side, if you like, of the Volunteers, and began to espouse more radical views.
Tell me about his wife and the influence of Sinead.
I think Sinead de Valera, his wife, has been overlooked in many ways. There hasn't really been a substantial biography of her. She was older than them. She was well developed in terms of her activities. She was a great admirer of the Irish language, helped to give extra curriculum classes in it at the National School where she taught. She was into the Irish Gaelic revival movement as an amateur actress and had acted with Douglas Hyde in one of his plays and had been praised by William Butler Yeats. So she was a powerful woman. And she gave it all up for Eamon de Valera and went through an awful lot for him after all. I mean, he chucked his job in a teacher training college in Dublin to go out in 1916, leaving her, who'd already given up her job, and three young children bereft and financially in dire straits. And she stuck with him throughout. And all his life was a great support. And, you know, although she became well known as a fairy tale writer later on, in many ways she was a much stronger woman than I think she's been given credit for. I suggest that, you know, if we could find more papers belonging, some of her papers are missing. Some letters, for instance, that de Valera sent to her, a few dozen, they emerged at a sale in Mealy's in Castlecomer in County Kilkenny at one stage and were seized by the Gardaí on the direction of the de Valera family. And apparently, according to the Gardaí, were later returned, having been stolen from the family. And I wasn't able to locate them. Not everything you would like to find is in the UCD de Valera paper archives, although there is a great deal in there and they were very helpful to me, but there are definitely gaps.
Do we have any idea what Pádraic Pearse or any of the other 1916 leaders thought of him?
This is one of the problems with the papers. I mean, there's nothing much in the papers that help you to form a view on his relationship with Griffith or Pearse or indeed even with Collins. He may have gone for the Cork job with the assistance of Pádraic Pearse, because Pearse had gone down to Cork himself and met with J.J. Horgan about some matters. So it's quite possible that it was he gave the idea to de Valera to go down that route. But they don't tell us very much. And indeed, about 1916, while there are extensive notes and writings by himself about certain matters in the de Valera papers, there's not what a historian would regard as much material there about 1916, you know, and his precise role in relation to all of that. He emerges from 1916 as a survivor. He describes himself as a monument to the dead of 1916. And it's at that point in ways that because he survives as the if you like, the sole long-term commandant who survived that he becomes a symbol. And it's a very important part, I think, of our understanding of de Valera, that we take his early upbringing and his self-contained, isolated character and put it together with this elevated notion of him as a monument to the dead in 1916, to use his word, and as a symbol of the Republic, if you like, during the treaty negotiations. He remains a symbol throughout and manages to survive everything. And I think that is the force of de Valera in many ways. It's not so much as a politician, because in some ways at that stage particularly, he was not an experienced politician or a good politician. But he represents something deep, the sort of sum of our contradictions in some ways in Irish politics, that contradiction between the constitutional tradition and the revolutionary tradition.
Is it as simple as that, that he was the sole commandant who survived, the symbol of 1916? Because in your chapter on destiny, you do explore, and it is really intriguing the way you explore, how the leadership kind of almost seemed to devolve to him, or how he became a leader in that period afterwards, that it's hard to kind of maybe trace and to try and delineate what led to this, but he just seemed to assume, or the power seemed to flow to him.
Well, the power flowed to him partly because the militants in after 1916 made sure he was projected forward as their representative, as it were. And he takes the presidency of Sinn Féin. Griffith gracefully, as it was said at the time, yielded to him rather than split the movement. And then, of course, during the War of Independence, he spends most of that out of Ireland, sent to America, where he's located at the Waldorf Hotel in New York, and ranges out across the United States and is met by exultant crowds and greeted everywhere as President of Ireland, even though there was no such role. He was President of the Ó Éireann. This is the period when he is made an honorary Native American chief. And he comes back with this, although he wasn't entirely successful in raising the kind of money they had hoped, he comes back towards the, well into the War of Independence, and he has this terrific additional status. And he was very much attached to this. And in some ways, I think this is why he was so put out by the role that the British monarch was to retain in the independent Irish state. Because in a way, he was already being touted as King of Ireland in popular songs. And he saw himself very much as remaining, I think, the symbol. Partition was not the great issue that we now think it was. It was not debated much in the treaty debate, 9 pages out of over 300, according to one estimate. And of course, there is also the extraordinary speech that De Valera gave in August 1921 in Ó Éireann, which is almost forgotten, in which he said that any county in Ireland that wanted to opt out of an Irish republic should have the right to do so. I think John Bowman, in his book on De Valera and Ulster, was the first person to bring attention really to this. And it still doesn't get the attention it deserves. It was locked away for many years, the speech, along with other proceedings of the private sessions of Ó Éireann that they had at that stage. But I think it highlights the fact that 4 months before the guys were sent to London to negotiate the treaty, partition was not the big issue. It was the crown, the symbolism. Symbolism was immensely important to De Valera. It kept him elevated from the crowd. He was very much an individual. This had been his character, and it remained his status as the chief. In fact, it was said by close associates that that was all people ever called him. Nobody really was known to call him Éamon, virtually. One or two people, Harry Boland, I think, might have. But generally, he was known as the chief. And that, I think, is a really indicative sign of the kind of role he has played in Irish society, even in the head of people who supported Fianna Fáil and voted for it. He stood for something. He was a symbol of a kind of aspiration rather than a practical politician.
And hard to believe then that someone who opposed the treaty, who ended up in jail, released in 1924, hard to believe that within a few short years, he was going to be back as the head of government, who was going to be then in the years ahead rewriting the constitution, being in power for so long, that you probably wouldn't have put any money on that back in 1924.
No, absolutely not. Now, I stop at the foundation of Fianna Fáil, and that's deliberate. There are other biographies, David McCullough's, for example, and others about De Valera that go deeply into him as a politician later on. But certainly, I mean, I talk about his wild speeches during the prelude to the Civil War, or the initial phases of the Civil War, when he, you know, he was warning that people would have to wade through the blood of Irishmen and even of members of the Irish government if the treaty was approved. And he tried to claim these were warnings rather than threats, which is a rather nice distinction that's very hard to maintain when you read the repeated nature of these speeches. But even in the Civil War, he was marginalised. He wasn't much of a figure to the anti-treaty side, and he regretted, in fact, having been extreme as he was. But to think that this man, who was virtually marginalised then, is released from prison along with a lot of other people who fought in the Civil War and catapulted almost into a position where he's able to found Fianna Fáil and bring in a whole plethora of people who are anti-treaty, and in no time at all remodel himself is certainly one of the remarkable features of Irish politics. But he must have been tapping some chord in the Irish population because whatever he founded as a party certainly has resonated to this very day.
Well, my thanks to Professor Colm Kenny for joining me tonight to talk about his new book, Dangerous Ambition, The Making of Éamon de Valera. It's published in paperback by Eastwood Books. The author, as I say, Colm Kenny. And Colm, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back. We're Talking History. A new book delves deeply into the evolution of Ireland's rural history to explore rural Ireland before and after some momentous transitions. And it examines the role and power of ruling politicians and state bodies, farmers, clerical and non-clerical civic activists intellectuals, including social commentators as well as fiction writers, returned emigrants and farm women, and how they promoted or impeded a wide range of rural changes. The book is called Inside Rural Ireland, Power and Change Since Independence. It's edited by Tomás Finn and Tony Varley and published in paperback by University College Dublin Press. And I'm delighted to welcome one of the editors, Tomás Finn, back to the show tonight. Tomás, you're very welcome.
Thanks very much, Patrick.
It's a fascinating collection of essays because, as the subtitle says, it's really exploring power and change since independence. So can you tell me about the concept behind and what exactly you wanted to explore in these essays?
Well, it is exactly that. Who was in power, who had the agency, and also how they used that power to affect change, or not to affect change in these different cases. So broadly, the nationalists, as they gained power through the Irish Revolution and through the Irish state, farmers through land reform, their dominant class, and how they tried to, I suppose, uphold their own position or try to make changes to Ireland. Also the church and clerical writers, through obviously the popular support of the church, but also those who are powerless, whether it's landless labourers or labourers broadly, and obviously their ability to affect change was quite limited, but also women, were they also powerless, and could they, did their position change, and how did that change over the course of the 20th century into the 21st century?
And it also looks at the agency of certain marginalised groups and the impacts of modern challenges like emigration, climate change. So it's a nuanced view of rural evolution and power.
Absolutely. Well, that's one of the questions. And there's different views within this collection. Historian Mary Daly would be quite positive, you know, where rural Ireland is today. Population has dramatically increased, as it has of all of Ireland. Maybe that's one of the stories of the book. If rural Ireland is doing well, Ireland is doing well. If Ireland's not doing well, rural Ireland's not doing well. But there's others would have a more negative view, say, for example, the view of a position of women, you know, that they were in some ways subordinate to a patriarchal for much of the 20th century. But I do think you can trace the change first half of the 20th century up to after World War II. It was quite difficult to effect change. But you can see even then in the 40s and 50s, even into war period, emergence of a group like Muintir na Tíre, People of Ireland. And they were a clerical-led body, but they were also involved, laity were involved, women were involved, women and men, women maybe more in the secretarial positions, but did have officer positions. But you can see a role like them and others like the Irish Country Women's Association trying to improve lives for rural people in terms of electrification, sewerage, water, maybe trying to gain industry. But really, it's into probably the 1960s, 1970s, when the state becomes much more involved in planning society and the economy, that you can trace a lot, many of the big changes, like free post-primary education into the 1970s, obviously the rule of what became the European Union. Ireland becomes a member in 1973, and also moves towards equal pay, even though, of course, we've some way to go for that in that area as well. But I think there's the story I would see as quite relatively positive, but you know that is absolutely contested, and you see that in some of the chapters in this book.
Talk to me about some of the state interventions when it's come to planning. What have been the most significant state interventions, and how successful have they been?
Touching on a couple there, in the 1960s, free post-primary education, or and the state different plans in terms of economic control and mass. But the two chapters, I suppose, touching a lot on this is those by Gróða Tuig. And there's very well-known historians, Gróða Tuig, Mary Daly, sociologists such as Brian Fanning and Anne Byrne. But the two chapters on by Gróða Tuig, he talks about the British state, the congested district board from the late 19th, early 20th century, trying to tackle the areas of the Western seaboard and the difficulties they were confronting. The new Irish state was very interested in the Gaeltacht area, so similar areas, Irish language areas, but was much less successful and much less specific in its proposals. The more the approach was to try to improve Ireland, and then broadly that rural Ireland would improve as a part of that. That doesn't really happen. You know, though there was many people left behind. limited choices, you know, hoping that the Land Commission, and that's a very interesting body, but a body we don't know that much about, that they would transfer land. But, you know, broadly, there was obviously a lot of obviously resistance to, you know, people losing land. But it's into the 1960s that the, you know, and Mín Tírnáthaire is an important part of this. You can think of their support for, I'm even thinking of James Dillon when he was the Minister for Agriculture in the first inter-party government from 1948 to 51. But he urges women not to get married until you have water in the taps in the kitchen. So Munter would have supported those types, rural electrification. That's a dramatic. You know, I would often see Ireland as evolving rather than revolutions, but rural electrification is a revolution. But it's into the 60s. And then, Munter would, by that point, would look for partnership with the state, whereas had been reluctant to fully engage with the state, trying to guard its own independence and not be, as it would see it, not be subsumed by the state. So it's that period that I think the really more successful initiatives, and 60s are a period of planning broadly, and then planning wasn't as successful, but the state became central to everyone's lives. And then the European Union. You know, the European Union has been hugely important in the emergence of supports for agriculture and farmers to ensure that the farms have been continued to be viable, that farms that wouldn't have been viable. But it's in rural Ireland, I suppose, it's also off farm incomes. They've become increasingly important to, again, ensure that farms that wouldn't exist today, they can exist. And I think that evolution of, for women especially, to have a significant role and have now moving away from that patriarchal structure towards more of a partnership role. And that's been hugely important in the latter half of the 20th century.
And fascinating to look at the role of intellectuals as well, including fiction writers, and how they're at times romanticising rural life, at times they're critiquing it, and definitely making a contribution in terms of the changes that are happening.
Absolutely. And there's two chapters, different sections in the book. One there, I'll just touch on state and rural intervention. Another broadly on Munter, but other bodies as well, church and civil society. The one you're mentioning, intellectuals and authors and different social commentators. But we also have on contemporary Ireland as well. But go back to authors and different intellectuals. Katrina Clear looks at different fiction writers. And there is a view out there, absolutely, that, you know, they would romanticise. But the ones she looks at, perhaps the lesser well-known, that they look at the reality. And it's very interesting. And there's no real sense of many of these authors that there's a real clash between rural or urban areas. There seems to be quite easy transition. And very much, and people would be very much attracted to dance halls, cinema, music, maybe not necessarily jazz music, but, you know, certainly very interested in the modern amenities, very aware of the world, World War II, what's happening as well in many of these books. But into Brian Fanning, his work is also a really important, very well-known sociologist, but he looks at Cardinal Newman and becomes a archbishop, and he often would be viewed as a very reactionary, conservative figure, and maybe he was when he was bishop, but before that he's a very important sociologist, very important in Mún Tírnáthaire, but he's looking for rural Ireland to survive, to remain viable, and he looks at different ways for that to happen, and especially the development of rural towns, and arguably that's the area that have been less successful. Maybe rural Ireland is doing well, but it's the rural towns in many ways that have been bypassed. And that's another story of modern Ireland.
Tell me about the cover of the book, because there's a wonderful picture of a woman giving a talk. She's speaking from someone, but then in front of her, there's a priest who has a hand over his face as if he's not quite appreciating what is being said.
That's Canon Hayes. So that's the person who established and organized and central driving force behind Mún Tírnáthaire. And to be fair to him, I don't think he would be very open to women playing a role, maybe not the central role, but, you know, but women did play an important role in Mún Tírnáthaire. And again, he was very much an advocate for modern Ireland, making sure rural Ireland was attractive to people to live in. But we don't know what's happening here. And as you say, it's a woman speaking. She may be saying, if you open up the whole flap, you can see a couple of people smiling, laughing, as if she might be saying something funny. So I don't know. Is it, as you say, Canon Hayes not really sharing the humor, or it could be that he's just resting, or it could be the flash of the camera. We don't know exactly, but it's, you know, that sense of young people and women and men involved in different civil society organizations and do challenge the patriarchy and trying to improve rural and modern and affect modern Ireland, I think is very evident from that photo and other photos in there. It's a very good collection, the Meath na Tíre Archive. The whole collection book evolved from that, you know, discussion between those in Galway, but internationally, many historians and social scientists. And that was the aim of this book, bring all different voices together to understand modern Ireland broadly, but rural Ireland specifically. But the Meath na Tíre Archive, some wonderful photos. There's other photos in the collection, but it's a really valuable collection in terms of understanding how rural Ireland engaged with the state, but also engaged with the European Union.
And that's actually brilliant how it shows how the photograph can be interpreted different ways. And there's not just one way you can view it. And some brilliant stuff in it as well about how women were agents of change throughout the 20th century in rural Ireland and through various different organisations, through various different roles that were very much actively involved in these changes.
Absolutely. My own chapter looks at Meath na Tíre and Tuairim's relationship with church and state. Tuairim's symbol on their front page was a woman's face superimposed on a man. So very much emphasizing the need for equality and highlighting that. And Tuairim had a number of women and men very active and, you know, centrally involved. Meantime, maybe less so the leaders, but also they were also the officer, had officer positions. Another organization like the Irish Country Women's Association, you know, it would have maybe 20,000 members in the 1940s. Again, very active in trying to look for better ways for people to live, make rural Ireland more attractive. You'd have the Housewives Association, more urban body. You know, so there are absolutely these organizations, but they often would also clash. Like Meantir, the women in Meantir maybe didn't see themselves, or other women didn't see Meantir as offering the same possibilities, perhaps as the Irish Country Women's Association. So there's also that happening. But in other areas, they would work together in terms of like rural electrification. And Meantir would work with Machnar na Foirme, for example. I think all these bodies have played an important role, but, you know, there's still resistance there. I'm not even thinking of the National Ploughing Association. That's had a female leader ahead of it for decades. And they still, or they have at least, referred to female farmers as farmettes. You know, again, so that hesitancy. There's another body I'm thinking of and very important playing, Land Mobility Service. And my brother, Austin Vince, actually headed that. But it tries to provide opportunities for women and men to become farmers and inherit land and organize that from other farmers that may not have some obvious heir. So that plays, you know, and National Farmers Association, Irish Farmers Association, I should say, also is trying to have roles for making sure women are active and are represented. But I think still an awful lot of work can and needs to be done in all this area.
The book also explores the scourge of emigration and the impact that had on various different rural communities.
Yeah, well, the options for people, you go back to the 19th century, especially those that were in the lower socioeconomic background, you know, they were limited, whether to hope that you gain some land or more land to make sure that you could have an area that was viable and sustainable, or else to emigrate. The hope was, you know, there was some progress made in as Gróda Tuig shows in before independence by the congested district board in trying to develop on specific projects. But, you know, you go into it since independence, even with the congested district board, the progress was limited. You know, for a lot of people, there was no real alternative, perhaps, to having to leave Ireland. But into the interwar period, we'd have the Great Depression, Wall Street crash, and then the economic war. And, you know, with the Great Depression, there wasn't that many, as much of an opportunity to leave, because simply the opportunities were not as available in the interwar period. But emigration returns with a force in the 1950s, absolutely. And it's in that period you can see, for example, Meantir being more active in terms of proposing different projects, a parish plan involving rural electrification, as I say, different proposals to try to really seek ways to improve modern Ireland. But, you know, again, it wasn't sufficient. This is quite clear. It's really into the 1960s and improvements in the economy and society. There were more opportunities at that stage. But emigration has, you know, continues to be a feature of Irish life, absolutely. But it's the first half of the 20th century, you can see it, huge difficulties. I think this story since the 1960s, 70s has been more positive.
And it's fascinating to see the preoccupations and concerns in earlier parts of the story, you know, the interest or the fear of communism or the threat of class war, that there are these external pressures that loom large and things that are seen as great pressures.
Absolutely. And Canon Hayes is very interesting in all of that as well. Owen Devereux, in his work, he looks at Canon Hayes and very important in terms of organizing, making Munter. It never became a nationwide body, but it became very active in large parts of the country. And his role was crucial in all of that. But he was also, you know, he's also in some ways an admirer, had certain, let's say, fascist leanings as well. But not just him, others, Edward Coyne, for example, Alfred O'Halloran, major clerical figures, you know, that sympathy, that what was out there with more maybe undemocratic forms, you know, having stronger leadership, that's also out there. But in terms of class also, you know, Munter and other organizations were less successful in providing opportunities. Hayes did want Munter to be a holistic body for all classes, but perhaps he was less successful in enabling those that were, you know, in the poorer sections of society to be really come involved. And, you know, you can see that also in the Irish Country Women's Association as well.
And it's fascinating the way looking at the historical trajectory of rural Ireland does help us perhaps better plot that story forward and make some plans for what could happen.
Absolutely. Well, again, I think the story of this book in many ways is if Ireland is doing well, rural Ireland is doing well. But and if rural Ireland is doing well, Ireland is doing well. It's the story of modern Ireland in that sense in many ways. But less true is, like, in your sense, maybe that existed in the interwar or earlier decades in the 20th century. You know, a different views between rural and urban Ireland, you know, and also in terms of education, areas, people in rural Ireland in many ways would be even better education than some people. You know, obviously cities, urban areas are very divided in some of this. So, you know, again, you know, the story of rural Ireland is very positive in many ways, but there are still, of course, real challenges to address.
Well, my thanks to Tomás Finn, the co-editor of this wonderful new collection of essays, for joining me tonight. The book is called Inside Rural Ireland, Power and Change Since Independence. It's published in paperback by University College Dublin Press. The editors, Tomás Finn and Tony Varley. And Tomás, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Patrick.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back. We're Talking History. The relationship between language, thought and culture is of concern to anyone with an interest in what it means to be human. And a new book draws on the latest discoveries in archaeology, linguistics, psychology and genetics to reconstruct the steps by which language evolved. And it explains how it transformed the nature of thought and culture. How we talked our way out of the Stone Age and into the world of farming and then swiftly into today's digital age. The book is called The Language Puzzle, How We Talked Our Way Out of the Stone Age. It's published in hardback by Profile Books. The author is Stephen Miven. And Stephen, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you very much.
Talk to me about that idea then, about how we talked our way out of the Stone Age. That kind of will intrigue and perhaps confuse our listeners.
Well, yeah, I hope it doesn't really. I think we need to start with thinking that, you know, the language is probably the most important, amazing attribute that we all have. And we really use our language to drive cultural change, technical change, political change and so forth. And whereas we think that the end of the Stone Age came about by inventions of pottery, inventions of farming and so forth, we also need to think what drove those inventions? How could they have come about? And, you know, my research really concludes that it's really by the evolution of language that gave humans the capability to make those types of innovations and developments that have really driven our culture out of the Stone Age and very swiftly, because that only ended 10,000 years ago at most, into this modern day world.
So how did recent archaeological and genetic discoveries shape your views?
Well, there's there's a constant flow of new discoveries and new ideas. Now, I'm an archaeologist, and you know, the sort of data I deal with are discoveries of human fossils, and we can look at the size and the shape of the brain, and we can reconstruct the vocal tract from those. We can look at the sort of tools that people are making and speculate, perhaps, about what sort of thought processes, what sort of communication they're so to make them. But really, to explore language, we have to draw on a really wide range of disciplines, because so many have information, theories, and evidence to contribute. You know, genetics is making huge progress in understanding the genetic basis of language, and we can now, by drawing on ancient DNA, make some discoveries about the sorts of genes that our ancestors may have had and how they may have influenced how their brains developed and the capacities they gave. But also there's research in linguistics and psychology and how children acquire language. And my book's called The Language Puzzle, because really all these different disciplines are providing bits of the puzzle that we've got to put together to try to find a comprehensive view of how language came about. It's a tremendously exciting area, and the last two decades have seen some remarkable developments in all these disciplines. So it's been a very exciting project for me to try to piece them together to discover what the story was.
And there are big debates about the evolution of language, with some arguing that there was a sudden emergence and others saying that there was a gradual evolution. Why is that debate so strong, and where do you stand in that debate?
Yeah, I mean, you know, people have been speculating about the evolution of language ever since classical times. Plato speculated about the invention of words, and then during the Enlightenment, there was a huge burst of interest in it. And then, particularly during the last three decades, there's been a constant flow of theories. Some, such as Noam Chomsky, arguing that language arose from some sudden genetic development just about 100,000 years ago, whereas others prefer the idea of a long, gradual, slow emergence of a linguistic ability. I'm sure that the latter view is right. The idea that something as complex in language can just suddenly emerge seems, seems a bit nonsense to me. And as with other complex biological and cultural capacities, you know, as Darwin taught us, these tend to evolve very slowly and gradually over long periods of time. I'm sure language is exactly the same. I suspect our modern types of language that we have today, you know, the complex grammars we have and the large lexicons, I suspect that did emerge relatively recently, about 150,000 years ago. But our ancestors prior to that had lots of maybe simpler types of language or different types of language that were as important to them in their daily lives as our language today is to us.
Tool making was hugely important, and again, it's something that people mightn't think is hugely significant, but actually it was central to the development of linguistic capabilities.
Yeah, that's right. You can imagine that tool making can implicate various linguistic skills. You know, even from, say, about 1.5 million years ago, we're seeing our ancestors making very sophisticated stone tools. They're requiring them to find the right sort of stone. They're using a whole series of different sequences of mapping actions. They're imposing form onto these tools. So that craft, if you like, has got to be transmitted from generation to generation. And language may have been necessary to do that. It may not. It may have just been by observational learning. But it's also thought that the sort of cognitive processes that are required to put a series of actions together to make a tool are not significantly different to the cognitive processes used to put, say, words together to make a sentence. And indeed, some neuroscientists have done brain scanning of people when speaking, making utterances, and when making tools, and can see that similar areas of the brain are being used in both processes. So it might be that we can use stone tools in the past as a proxy for the linguistic capabilities of our ancestors, even though we can't identify specifically what those linguistic capabilities may have been.
Did various changes to climate influence language development?
Yeah, it must have done in all sorts of ways. If you go right back to the early stages of human evolution, when our ancestors were evolving in Africa, the earliest were living in fairly wooded forest environments. Within those, they're probably living in quite small groups and spending a lot of time in the trees, which gave them quite a good safe place to escape from predators. But major climate change from 4 million years ago led to drying out of the landscapes, retreat of the forests, and our ancestors had to move to living on fairly open savannas. They were much more dangerous places, and they had different ranges of types of food available. They probably had to live in larger social groups and rely on much higher degrees of cooperation. It was then they probably had to start making stone tools so they could get sharp flakes to butcher carcasses that they were probably scavenging from hyena and lion kills. So that changes in their social and ecological and economic lives probably was a great pressure to enhance communication, not just gesturally, but verbal communication. And then also throughout human evolution, there's been periods of relative cold, ice ages, and relative warm interglacial periods like living in today. And those constantly change the size of populations. They cause populations to become separated from each other. And that not only helped generate the need for communication and language, but also the proliferation of different languages as communities became relatively isolated from each other. So climate change is always a story of what in human evolution of whatever features we're dealing with.
And it's also fascinating, you have a chapter on how words keep changing. Words change their meaning over time since the first words were spoken. And that also is significant because you've talked about in the book about these iconic words. And then when you have these changes to the meaning, that's also advancing things considerably.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of process that we're all familiar with today. You know, our language, our lexicons are constantly changing. You know, we can just think over the last few years where we've become familiar with words like cloud have a meaning totally different from a cloud in the sky. It's the big storage of data somewhere that nobody's quite sure where they are. And in fact, in technology, we're borrowing words constantly. We used to use the word mouse for an item for moving cursors around on the screens. So we're all familiar with how meanings of words are constantly changing. What I suggest is that process of linguistic change today, we can write it back into the past, not just a few generations of the past, but into the deep past. So that can help us understand how some of the earliest words that were probably things like onomatopoeias to sort of capture the things they heard in the environment and repeat them, gradually change their form and the meaning through the millions, the billions of utterances and conversations were made by our ancestors through time. So from fairly basic words to start with, we can draw on those processes that linguists have revealed today to understand that long-term evolution of the lexicon. And then, of course, how languages diverge. Once populations become separate, some change their words in one direction relating to the sorts of tasks and needs they have, and others do likewise elsewhere.
And what about how words change how they're sounded and how we pronounce them?
Yeah, well, we often, that also happens through that process of change. Partly in the human past, our vocal tracts have changed in shape and size due to other factors. So, for instance, our earlier ancestors generally had much larger teeth than us because they're processing much coarser, drier foods at large molars. Now, as tooth size became smaller because of eating more meat and fruit and so forth, the vocal cavity became larger, which enabled a wider range of different sounds to be made. Simply, if you think of the Neanderthals had very large noses, and that probably gave a lot of their speech a rather nasal quality. But then today, even among modern humans, the sounds of words constantly change. We mishear, we mispronounce, and so forth. And sometimes sound changes play an active role in different accents by the way words are particularly pronounced. And we see that, of course, very well in dialects throughout Britain today.
You engage in another wonderful debate in the book where you have a chapter on whether language changes how we view the world and how we think about the world. And whether if you grow up learning and speaking and thinking in one language, you might have a slightly or maybe a more significant view of the world than someone who grows up with an entirely different language.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's been a very long debate in philosophy, linguistics, psychology and so forth, whether the language you speak influences the way you perceive and think about the world. In one way, they have to, because different languages have different types of words, and the words are the concepts that you have about the have about the world. But trying to demonstrate is the case has challenged linguists through the years. You know, do communities who only have words for a few colours, like black, white, and red, do they still perceive the blues and the greens and the oranges and the yellows, just as we do? Well, yes, they probably do, even though they don't possibly conceive of them in the way that we do. But, you know, if you ask somebody who speaks a wide range of different languages, and you say, hey, when you speak a different language, does it make you feel different? You know, do you feel a different sort of person? Normally they say they do. So we have sort of a lot of anecdotal accounts that, yes, of course the language we speak makes us feel differently, makes us think differently about the world, as opposed to trying to demonstrate through academic research has been extremely difficult. But it's a fascinating area of thought, fascinating to think about how the words and the grammar and our pronunciations may actually influence how we're thinking about the world and how we act in it.
And your book actually shows how dependent we all became on words, that humanity depends on them, and they kind of control every aspect of our lives.
Yeah, well, I think they do. You know, that's partly my original motivation for writing the book. You know, as an academic and archaeologist, I want to write about the most important things for humanity, and I just can't avoid the conclusion that is language. And what's really striking is after about 100,000 years, and then especially after the end of the Ice Age, last Ice Age at about 10,000 years ago, culture has just moved forward so quickly, become so complicated and changes so rapidly. And there's got to be something driving that. You know, we invented farming around 10,000 years ago. Soon after that, we invented metallurgy. Then the early civilizations, eventually they led to the Industrial Revolution, the Digital Revolution. Now, what's the drive going through that? Well, I think the basic drive is our use of words. Those millions of conversations and utterances and chit-chats and speeches that we have. And this is constantly changing the way we think, allowing new ideas to emerge, and ultimately enable us to generate new culture and technological change. Which makes us, you know, wonder about language today and how it's constantly changing and how it influencing what we think about the world and what might emerge in the future. Of course, AI is really interesting in that, in the sense that AI might take some of the decisions out of us and reduce the significance of human language in terms of future change.
Well, it's a book that's been described as a tour de force, as well as a wonderful biography of the single most important thing we all share, language. The book is called The Language Puzzle, How We Talked Our Way Out of the Stone Age. It's published in hardback by Profile Books. The author is Stephen Mithen. And Stephen, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much, Patrick. It was great.
Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marais O'Sullivan, and Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.